The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia. Reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. The Time Magazine issue from which I'll be reading today is dated January 18/January 25, 2021. That indicates it's a double issue for 2 weeks running. It is the usual red-bordered front page of Time magazine with large block letters Time superimposed in white upon a photographic background. Today, the photograph is by Drew Angerer of Getty Images. It depicts BioNTech co-founders Dr. Ugur Sahin and Dr. Özlem Türeci in its headquarters in Germany, January 3. One of these individuals, Dr. Ugur, perhaps, is male. Dr. Özlem, female. Both are wearing long white lab coats. Both are looking directly into the camera. He has very short cropped dark hair and dark eyes. Neither of them is smiling, actually. She has, it's not long hair, but it's definitely not short. It's very, very dark. It looks black in this photograph. She's wearing glasses, too, black rimmed glasses. And the cover title is The Vaccine Revolution, Racing to Beat the Virus. Proceeding now with The View, World, The Risks of 2021 by Ian Bremmer. The healthcare response to the pandemic defined 2020. The economic response to its lasting damage will define 2021. A world in crisis will miss the leadership and cooperation of a well-functioning superpower. With the most powerful country as divided as the U.S. is now, the geopolitical recession is sure to deepen. The View opener. America's growing divisions are why we must start with the problem of political legitimacy there. Here are the top risks of the year ahead. And the first one says 46*. Joe Biden's term opens the era of the asterisk presidency in the U.S., a time when the Oval Office occupant is seen as illegitimate by roughly one-third of the country and by the lawmakers that election skeptics sent to Congress. Most of the risk here is domestic, with President-elect Biden the weakest executive to take office since Jimmy Carter in 1976. But the consequences of extreme polarization for democratic legitimacy extend well beyond U.S. borders, beyond a shared desire to contain China. Republicans and Democrats will disagree sharply with one another and among themselves over the objectives of U.S. foreign policy. Long COVID-19. In 2021, the lingering symptoms of COVID-19 will threaten not just lives, but also political stability and the global economy. Countries around the world will struggle to meet ambitious vaccination timelines, and the pandemic will leave a legacy of high debt, displaced workers, growing inequality, and lost trust. The bumpy vaccine rollout and economic scar tissue of the pandemic will stoke anti-incumbent anger and public unrest, in many countries. The race to net zero. Climate policy is becoming a higher national priority and an arena of global competition. Across a range of clean technologies, China's long-standing industrial policy approach will face an aggressive counteroffensive from D.C. Some parts of the clean energy supply chain will experience bifurcation pressures like those seen in 5G. The push for net zero emissions targets will create enormous opportunities for private capital. U.S.-China competition broadens. A shared desire in Washington and Beijing for stability in U.S.-China relations will ease headline tensions, but U.S. coordination of China competition, together with allies, along with vaccine nationalism and dueling climate tech strategies, will combine with long-standing frictions in other areas to further complicate their rivalry. Global data reckoning. A slowdown to the free flow of sensitive data across borders will raise costs for companies and disrupt popular apps and internet business models. Even as the data-driven 5G and AI revolutions gain steam, governments concerned about who is accessing their citizens' data and how will erode the foundation of the open global Internet. Cyber tipping point. There is no single factor that raises the risk of a major disaster in cyberspace in 2021. The digital realm where any computer or smartphone can become an entry point for hackers and nation-states and criminal acts with relative impunity is too unpredictable. Instead, a combination of low probability but high impact risks and increased threats will make this the year that cyber conflict creates unprecedented risk. Out in the cold, Turkey. Economic setbacks in 2021 and Turkey's poor COVID-19 response will leave President Recep Tayyip Erdogan struggling to win back voters disillusioned with his two-decade rule. These dynamics will stoke social tensions, prompt a crackdown against the opposition, and encourage Erdogan to launch more foreign policy adventures to fuel nationalism and distract his supporters. Low oil takes a toll. The Middle East is the biggest regional loser from coronavirus. Its energy-producing countries faced a collapse in global oil demand in 2020 that left governments in nations from Algeria to Iran with less cash flowing into their coffers. Things will get worse in 2021, with many of these governments cutting spending, damaging vulnerable private sectors, and fueling unemployment. Europe after Merkel. Angela Merkel's departure later this year, after 15 years as Germany's chancellor, will drive the continent's top risk. Europe faces an economic hangover from intensified lockdown restrictions in several countries, and Merkel won't be there to encourage flexibility in the multilateral response. Any economic setback could thus threaten Europe's fragile recovery. This page does feature a photo of Angela Merkel, who has been in power since 2005 and who will step down this year. She has her usual short strawberry blonde haircut. It's straight and combed back away from her face. She is wearing a bright blue, a royal blue suit, apparently. One sees only her jacket. She's wearing a white face mask, and others surrounding her are wearing masks as well. Milestones. Died Pierre Cardin. Avant-garde trendsetter. For Pierre Cardin, who died in France December 29 at 98, fashion was a medium for envisioning the future. perhaps best known for the sculptural mod clothing that helped define the 1960s and 70s style, the designer leaves a rich legacy of innovative, daring work. Cardin founded his own fashion house in Paris in 1950 after working under Christian Dior and Elsa Schiaparelli. In the decades that followed, he established himself as a fearless trailblazer. His designs, including futuristic space-age bubble dresses, the wildly popular Nehru suit jacket, and even a NASA space suit, embodied the cultural zeitgeist and often preempted it. Even more revolutionary was his vision for a diversified namesake brand. Cardin licensed his name on everything from fragrances and furniture to pickle jars and car interiors. This drive helped Cardin build a vast empire, characterized by seemingly limitless creativity and little regard for convention. Cardin embraced designing for the masses, flouting couture traditions and championing ready-to-wear or mass-market clothes far ahead of many contemporaries. He was one of the first French designers to tap then unexplored markets in Asia and Russia, where he found immense popularity. "I design for tomorrow," he once remarked. "I never go backward." And that article was written by Katie Lang. There's a photo here in black and white of Cardin with two models outside his house, which is labeled Pierre Cardin on the awning, apparently in Paris in July of 1979. He is stooped on the ground outside this structure, this very chic-looking facade, on a sidewalk, on a pavement, and he's wearing dark trousers, very shiny dark shoes, a light-colored jacket, a white shirt, probably, the photo's in black and white, and a medium-colored, very slender tie. He's looking upward at one of the very tall models, whose hem he is measuring from her upper thigh to the floor. One doesn't know how long that is, but this is an asymmetrical skirt that she's wearing. It's striped, and the stripes are on the bias, under which there appear to be dark trousers and also dark, perhaps, knee-high or thigh-high boots. The jacket also is striped, but its stripes are vertical. The shoulders are padded. This is from 1979. The collar is high. She's wearing a belt, and she has a tiny pillbox on her head. She's looking down at Monsieur Cardin. And the model on the other side of him is wearing high heels. Her dress is semi-fitted. It also has a vertical effect in the fabric, but the shoulders almost look winged. They have some stiffening that shows slight wingness to them. There are three very large buttons in the front, perhaps more. I'm unable to see them. They may be hidden in the folds because there are pleats in the front of the skirt of the coat. There is a collar, not a very large collar. And this model is also peering down and smiling at Monsieur Cardin. She's wearing a hat that comes down forward over her forehead. She has very short, very, very short cropped hair. And this smallish hat that is tilted forward on her forehead sports a very long feather, I would say maybe 2 feet long, and very avant-garde-looking outfits. Another article here, labeled Dyed, Brian Urquhart, that's U-R-Q-U-H-A-R-T. By the way, Monsieur Cardin's name is spelled C-A-R-D-I-N. Brian Urquhart, Keeper of Peace. This article is by David Bosco. A British airborne officer during World War II, Sir Brian Urquhart, knew exactly why the United Nations was needed. Urquhart, who died January 2 at 101, had seen the horrors of war and was convinced global organization was the only way to avoid global conflict. As an influential advisor to early UN leaders, Urquhart married this conviction with a pragmatic approach to political power. He helped fashion an invaluable tool for grappling with conflict and violence, UN peacekeepers. In years since, peacekeeping has evolved and on occasion stumbled, but never disappeared from the diplomatic toolbox. Urquhart chronicled the UN's early decades through biographies of key diplomatic figures, an autobiography, and myriad other writings. His wife, Sydney Urquhart, a longtime reporter and researcher at Time, died January 3 at 87. Along the way, Urquhart shared wisdom and wit with generations of diplomats and scholars. In countless small acts of generosity, he forged human links between the organization's past and future. There's a small photo here, a small inset photo of Sir Brian Urquhart. It's very interestingly against a crimson background, which certainly contrasts with his snow-white hair. He's looking determinedly into the camera lens. His eyes are dark. He's not smiling. He's wearing a light-colored jacket with a gray shirt and almost mustard-colored dull gold tie. Bosco is the author. This is the writer. David Bosco is the author of Five to Rule Them All, The UN Security Council, and The Making of the Modern World. More milestones: died Gilligan's Island star Don Wells, December 30 at 82, from complications related to COVID-19. Former Time correspondent Jim Wilworth, who wrote for the magazine for more than 30 years, he died December 23 at 77. BR exited the United Kingdom from the European Union's Single Market and Customs Union December 31 after years of exhaustive negotiations. Closed the DOJ's investigation into the 2014 police shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, December 29, with no charges. Awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to GOP Representative Devin Nunes, a staunch Trump ally, January 4. Administered the first Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine outside of trials to 82-year-old Brian Pinker in the UK, January 4. Seized a South Korean oil tanker by Iran's Revolutionary Guard in the Strait of Hormuz, January 4. The armed troops forced the ship to change course and sail to Iran. Shut down. Adobe's Flash software platform, December 31, along with the much-beloved monetized Facebook game and mobile app Farmville, which required Flash Player. The brief news, anthems anew. Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced a tweak to Australia's national anthem, Advance Australia Fair, December 31, changing a line in the first verse from "For we are young and free" to "For we are one and free" to better honor the country's indigenous history. Here are other anthems that have been altered to acknowledge progress and representation by Madeleine Roche. Austria. In 2012, Austria's national anthem, Land der Berge, Land am Strome, was made more gender-inclusive with lyrical changes including great sons to great daughters and sons and brotherly choirs to jolly choirs. South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa, in 1997 blended a previous national anthem and a popular hymn into a single song, which features verses in the country's five most spoken languages, Xhosa, Zulu, Sesotho, Afrikaans, and English. Canada. After 18 months of debate, Canada made its English language national anthem, O Canada, gender neutral in 2018, changing the words after true patriot love from in all thy sons command to in all of us command. Good question. This is by Ciara Nugent. What could climate change mean for the world's weather in 2021? 2020 was a year of extreme weather. Hot and dry conditions drove wildfires across vast areas of Australia, California, Brazil, and Siberia. A record-breaking Atlantic hurricane season landed a double blow of hugely damaging storms on Central America. Droughts pushed millions of people into hunger in Zimbabwe and Madagascar. A super cyclone unleashed grave floods on India. And 2020 may end up being the hottest year on record, despite the impact of La Nina, an ocean atmospheric phenomenon that tends to have a cooling effect on global temperatures. While in the past it has been difficult to say if single weather events were directly caused by climate change, scientists have proved that much of 2020's weather would have been far less likely or even impossible without the warming of the Earth. As we have released heat-absorbing greenhouse gases, global temperatures have risen, that is, global average temperatures have risen, destabilizing the climate we're used to and making once-rare extremes more likely. As our Earth continues to warm, scientists say periods of extreme heat will be more frequent and last longer. Wildfires driven by heat and dry conditions will become more likely. Hurricanes will be more destructive, carrying stronger winds and heavier rains. It is still impossible to know if 2021 will be as record-breaking as last year, says Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at UCLA. From one year to the next, there's still a lot of random variation superimposed on top of the long-term trends. But it is highly likely more extremes are on the way, he adds. While 2020 may have been a particularly extreme year, in contrast to individual years in the past, looking forward, what is more meaningful is that 2020 was really not an aberration. And there are some ominous early predictions to consider. In its outlook for this winter, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration anticipates below average precipitation and worsening drought conditions across many southern U.S. states. Meteorologists at Colorado State University say there's a 6 in 10 chance that the next Atlantic hurricane season will be very strong or above average. When it comes to the emissions that are driving the changes in our climate, 2020 was an anomaly. Global emissions of carbon dioxide hit a record high in 2019, but fell 7% in 2020 as a result of drops in activity during COVID-19 lockdowns starting in March. But more recent data show the figures have already rebounded, says Glenn Peters of the Center for International Climate Research. Peters expects emissions in 2021 will likely be near 2019 levels. What is uncertain is where emissions go from there. If governments' pandemic recovery packages are green and include lots of stimulus for renewable energies, you would reap the benefits later, Peters notes. It is a question of whether they set future reductions in motion. The brief news, three short articles under the heading News Ticker. Hong Kong activists arrested. 50 activists arrested under Hong Kong's new national security law in morning raids January 6, marking a further erosion of freedoms in the city. The arrests drew international condemnation. No charges in Jacob Blake shooting. Kenosha, Wisconsin, District Attorney Michael Gravely said January 5 he would not bring criminal charges against the police officer who shot and paralyzed 29-year-old Jacob Blake after an altercation between Blake and the police in Kenosha August 23. Blake's uncle called the decision a grave injustice. Timely thaw in Saudi-Qatari relations. Ahead of a landmark summit, Saudi Arabia agreed January 4 to reopen its borders to its Gulf neighbor Qatar, easing a three-year dispute that pitted the U.S. allies against each other. The kingdom, joined by Egypt, Bahrain, and the UAE, cut ties with the country in 2017. Accusing its rulers of supporting terrorism. The Brief, The Bulletin. Jack Ma, M-A, disappears after speaking out in Xi Jinping's China. Whether performing in rock concerts or starring in a kung fu movie, Jack Ma has always relished the limelight. But as of January 6, the founder of China's e-commerce behemoth Alibaba, and until recently the country's richest man, has not been seen in public for over 2 months. An Alibaba spokeswoman declined to comment on his whereabouts after it was revealed that Ma, 56, had been replaced by another Alibaba executive for the finale of a TV talent contest he had helmed, with his picture scrubbed from the gallery of judges. Rags to riches, Ma is beloved by millions as a self-made tech mogul who never learned how to code, and suffered repeated rejection on his way to a personal fortune worth $50 billion. As a party member who rubbed shoulders with China's top leaders, Ma even assumed an unofficial ambassadorial role. Still, his ostentation and defense of China's strict 9-9-6 work culture, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, also led some to decry him as a capitalist bloodsucker. Swift retribution. On October 24, Ma gave a speech in Shanghai that chided Chinese regulators for stifling innovation, compared local banks to pawn shops, and infuriated listening cadres. Just over a week later, China's securities watchdog nixed the much-touted, record-breaking $37 billion IPO of Alibaba's fintech arm, Ant Financial, 2 days before its debut and despite having earlier received a green light. And in late December, Ma's Ant Group was told to restructure to adhere to new anti-monopoly rules, shaving billions off its valuation. Global fallout. All this comes as China's attempting to write the rules of next-generation trade and technology, ambitions that hinge on visionaries like Ma, whose Alipay mobile payment service claims to have over 1.3 billion users. Yet given a slowing economy, rising debt, and mounting geopolitical headwinds, it's clear President Xi Jinping will not countenance any challenge to his authority. That article was written by Charlie Campbell, and the next article is really a caption beneath a photo of people who look absolutely despondent. They are people of color. One sees only two faces, both of whom are wearing masks. One is being shielded or held by another, and that person, the shielder or the holder, is wearing a brown stocking cap, wearing glasses, and the other person is not wearing glasses but is attired in a heavy black jacket. There are hands reaching out to him. One does not see the faces or the bodies of the people whose hands are holding him, but he is being held securely by many. The caption reads, "Calls for justice, bail, Gell, G-E-L-L-E, is consoled after speaking about his 23-year-old son, Dolal Id, during a January 3 rally at the gas station in Minneapolis, where Id, I-D-D, was shot and killed by police during a December 30 traffic stop. While the Minneapolis Police Department has released body camera footage, it says shows Id shooting at officers first, hundreds have continued to protest, demanding answers as to what transpired during the city's first police killing since George Floyd's death last May. Three short articles appear under the brief news ticker. Argentina legalizes abortion. Argentina's Senate in Buenos Aires, December 30, approved elective abortions up to the 14th week of pregnancy, a landmark move for a continent home to some of the world's most restrictive abortion laws. The vote came after years of grassroots organizing by abortion rights and feminist activists and was decried by anti-abortion groups. Vietnamese journalists jailed over propaganda. A court in Vietnam, January 5, found three journalists guilty of spreading anti-state propaganda charges, Human Rights Watch describes as bogus. Pham Chi Dung, Nguyen Thuong Thuy, and Li Hu Minh Thuan, known for work critical of the government, face jail sentences of 11 to 15 years. Russian hack in U.S. much broader than once thought. Now believed to be the work of the Russian intelligence service, the SolarWinds hacking incident may have impacted as many as 250 government agencies and companies, the New York Times reported January 2, far more than originally thought. The brief is what it says in big white letters, superimposed over a photo of a lot of people jammed into a small space outside a big doorway with fancy arches and fancy plaster or wood scroll work. And some of these people, well, all of them are dressed in heavy clothing. Some are wearing red caps. Some are wearing khaki and other dark-colored caps and stocking hats, and they appear to be male, but one does not see the faces, so it's not entirely sure. Well, one sees the faces of about half a dozen out of two dozen people. Wearing heavy jackets, some are holding up cell phones or other electronic devices. One has some kind of a club-like apparatus that is being held aloft. Another is carrying a flag, which is meaningless to me. It's got kind of yellow and orange and black and white and a leafy insignia with stars intertwined. And then there is a U.S. flag also predominantly displayed. And a person, one out of not very many out of this whole group, wearing a mask, and it looks like a handkerchief made out of stars and stripes fabric. And that person's wearing a white helmet, like a workman's helmet. This is the brief, and the caption for that photo reads, "Insurrection, a mob of pro-Trump extremists breached the Capitol January 6. Nation, what Trump wrought," by Molly Ball. The photograph is by Victor J. Blue. The brief is reported by Madeline Carlisle, Suyin Haynes, Sierra Nugent, Bill Perrigo, Madeline Roach, and Olivia B. Waxman. The brief opener, "We will never give up. We will never concede," President Donald Trump told the crowd of supporters he had summoned to Washington January 6. They heard him and obeyed. Within hours, a mob of self-styled revolutionaries waving Trump flags stormed the Capitol. And that is Capitol, with a capital C, A-P-I-T-O-L. Scaling scaffolding and breaking windows, they filled the marble halls. Shots were fired inside the building as lawmakers and their staff scrambled for cover, and tear gas filled the rotunda. For the first time since the Civil War, America would not have a peaceful transfer of power. Before the riot interrupted it, Trump's last-ditch attempt to steal the presidential election that he unambiguously lost was not going well. Vice President Mike Pence announced he would fulfill his ceremonial role of counting the state's electoral votes, rejecting Trump's demand to throw them out. The Republican Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, gave an impassioned speech rebuking colleagues who sought to disrupt the process on Trump's behalf. For 4 years, Trump's party had submitted to a Faustian bargain. Recognizing the loyalty he commanded from voters, officials fell in line, some gleefully, some grudgingly, beyond a president who pushed America nearly to its breaking point. Republicans decided that winning elections and wielding power justified ignoring Trump's authoritarian tendencies, his assaults on the political system, his attacks on the GOP's members and ideals. But 2 weeks before the end of his presidency, the price of enabling Trump for the GOP and the country alike became clear. In his final bid to overturn the election, Trump browbeat dozens of Republican lawmakers into objecting to the certification of Joe Biden's victory January 6, forcing partisans to take sides on his final challenge to democracy and the Constitution. In the process, Trump helped ensure the GOP candidates in two Georgia runoff elections would lose by slim margins, giving Democrats control of the Senate. A party that abandoned its principles to gain power has lost both. In the final weeks of his term, Trump ran amok. He vowed to ruin the careers of GOP officials who would not go along with his baseless election claims. He vetoed the annual military budget. He sided with Democrats by demanding $2,000 stimulus checks the GOP would not support. He painted the Georgia Senate races as rigged, prompting supporters to urge a ballot boycott. He urged patriots, and that's in quotes, to descend on D.C. for a final showdown at the Capitol. As the chaos unfolded, Trump tweeted a limp request for nonviolence and hours later released a video telling his supporters to go home while praising them and continuing to insist the election was stolen. It was fitting that Trump's term would end with a presidential mob attacking the seat of democracy, while his party's representatives went to war with one another. His political career began as an attack on the GOP establishment and succeeded because many in the party agreed with his revulsion for its leaders. At an election eve rally for Georgia's Republican candidates, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, Trump got his biggest cheers when he went after other Republicans, from the state's governor, Brian Kemp, to Pence. To Republicans who'd rejected Trump, the party reaped what it had sown. This is what the president has caused today, this insurrection, said Mitt Romney, the only Senate Republican to vote for Trump's impeachment in February as he evacuated the Capitol. After indulging so much anti-establishment rhetoric, paranoid conspiracy theories, and revolutionary cosplay, could they really be surprised that some of their supporters finally took matters into their own hands? The consequences will continue. An entire side of the political spectrum is gripped by delusion, feuding over the irrational demands of a solipsistic demagogue as their voters call on them to abandon democracy itself. When congressmen respond to a lost election by insisting the system is illegitimate, it begins to erode the basis of how a democratic republic is supposed to work, says Meredith McGehee, executive director of the Good Government Group, Issue One. This is the lit match that we're playing with at this point. Whether Trump is your pick or not, it's dangerous. After Trump lost the election, Republicans comforted themselves that they still held 50 seats in the Senate. But with the victories in Georgia, Democrats now have 50 as well. making them the majority once Vice President Kamala Harris is in place to break ties. Controlling the chamber means Biden will be better able to seat his preferred cabinet, appoint judges, tackle the pandemic, and revive the economy. But he may struggle to work with an opposing party that cannot even agree on whether his election was legitimate. Everyone understands that Republicans cannot win without some of these kooks, but they can definitely lose with them, says Amanda Carpenter, a former aide to Senator Ted Cruz turned anti-Trump commentator. Donald Trump is leaving the Republican Party as fractured as it has ever been. Some Republicans refused to support Trump from the outset, forming a never-Trump movement of dissident conservatives. Others tried to emphasize points of agreement until Trump made that impossible. Some were driven out of office for opposing him, but many just left. More than 50 congressional Republicans have retired since Trump took office. Most were replaced by younger, Trumpier members, the party's future. For those who stayed, responding to the president's outrages became a familiar routine. Either pretend it did not happen or find some tortured rationale to go along. So when Trump became determined to overturn the election, he was not crazy to think they would eventually be beaten into submission. And they were not crazy to think this would eventually blow over like past controversies. But Trump's obsession with the defeat only grew. When previously loyal figures like Attorney General Bill Barr refused to support him, he cast about for nuttier alternatives who told him what he wanted to hear, tweeted far-fetched conspiracy theories, and lashed out at those who expressed skepticism. It all culminated with the extraordinary congressional objection to Biden's victory. Under law, Congress's role is merely to affirm the Electoral College vote count certified by the states. But Trump's demand that the GOP object quickly won the support of many House Republicans, and Senator Josh Hawley announced he would join them, forcing a debate on the floor. A dozen other senators soon rallied to the cause. The attack on the Capitol came after an objection to Arizona's votes lodged by Cruz, who toadied his way back into Trump's good graces after decrying him as a pathological liar in 2016. Trump's final test caused fresh rifts in the party. A raid against loyalists like Hawley and Cruz in the Senate were not only relative moderates like Romney and Pat Toomey, but also hardcore Trumpists like Tom Cotton and Jim Inhofe. The GOP House leader, Kevin McCarthy, lent his support to the challenge, but a surprising collection of conservative members, such as Cruz's former chief of staff, Chip Roy, and the number three House Republican, Liz Cheney, opposed it, warning the effort could discredit the Electoral College as well as themselves. The double-barreled Georgia runoffs were a case study in the agonies of the Trump-era GOP. Biden narrowly won the state in November, the first Democratic presidential candidate to do so in nearly three decades, powered by the forces Trump supercharged. Surging turnout among black voters and a mass migration of suburban voters to the Democrats. Neither GOP senator mustered 50% of the vote, forcing both to compete in the January 5 runoffs. As Democrats Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff campaigned, Perdue and Loeffler watched in horror as Trump torched Georgia's GOP establishment. Kemp and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger earned death threats for insisting Biden had won the state. In a January 2 phone call that later became public, Raffensperger endured Trump's threats and cajoling for nearly an hour, but did not waver. Few conservatives had illusions about who they were dealing with. The Republican Party was a means to an end, the easiest patsy lying around, says Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee. I tried to warn people. You have invited someone in the House who does not give a damn about anyone else, much less than the House itself. As Trump leaves office, his party is more split and defeated than it was before he arrived. But it would be folly to predict that the embarrassment Trump has brought spells doom for Republicans. Despite his loss, Trump notched millions more votes in 2020 than in 2016 and spurred unprecedented GOP turnout. The party gained seats in the House and improved its performance with Latinos. The real threat to America may be not that this GOP cannot win elections, but that it can. The question now is how to sift through the ashes from Trump's final conflagration. Former GOP Representative Zach Wamp, WAMP, who leads a bipartisan election protection coalition, says an America where lies can overpower truth is one where authoritarianism can take root. I am not a never Trumper. I am from Tennessee. I saw the good things the president did for 4 years. I am grateful, Womp says, but this is no way to go out. His legacy is going to be this brainwashing of millions of people. The Republican Party has the potential to come back strong, but we cannot have a foundation built on a lie. With reporting also by Mariah Espada and Simone Shaw. There's a one-column article here, Trump supporters besiege the Capitol. It is a photographic spread, primarily, showing lawmakers and staff sheltering as protesters besiege the House chamber in the U.S. Capitol January 6. Most of these people, or all of them that I can see in the photo, are men wearing dark suits, white shirts, and red ties. Some are seated in theater-style chairs that are padded, and the seats fold up, and they're kind of blue with a geometric gold pattern design. Some are kneeling on the floor. Some are seated on steps leading down from double doors into the chamber. Some are wearing masks. Some are wearing glasses. Some are leaning as if in a lounging position on the floor between the rows of seats. Trump supporters besiege the Capitol by Vera Bergengruen with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Julia Zorthian. A mob whipped up by the president stormed police lines, smashed windows, and broke into the U.S. Capitol January 6 in an attempt to block lawmakers from certifying President-elect Joe Biden's electoral victory. The violent scene, which called to mind images of coups in foreign lands, was a culmination of 2 months of Stop the Steal rallies, fueled by Donald Trump's baseless allegations that widespread voter fraud had cost him the election. The president has repeatedly incited his supporters to challenge the peaceful transfer of power, the essential marker of democracy. 2 hours before the assault on the Capitol, Trump had vowed that he would never concede and urged them to pressure Republican lawmakers to take back our country. When he finished, a crowd chanting "Storm the Capitol" proceeded to the iconic building, overwhelmed police, and flooded inside. Inside the House chamber, police officers shoved furniture to barricade the doors as Vice President Mike Pence and lawmakers scrambled to evacuate. In the Senate, intruders dressed in everything from full-body armor to a horned Viking cap posed for photos at the rostrum, fists raised. A red MAGA hat was planted on the head of a bronze statue of former President Gerald Ford in the rotunda, and a Trump flag placed in his hands. Shots were heard, and a woman reported killed. As it all unfolded, control of the upper chamber moved from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party as, 600 miles to the south, civil servants and citizen volunteers continued to faithfully tally ballots. Here is an essay that may be abridged for time constraints, the good with the bad, living in the tangle of joy and pain, by Rebecca Taussig, T-A-U-S-S-I-G, the author of Sitting Pretty, the view from my ordinary, resilient, disabled body. It was a night in mid-April that I fell asleep to the phrase, "This is too hard," pinging through my brain, and they were the first words to cross my mind when I opened my eyes the next morning. I texted my sisters, "Remember the easy days when it was just a baby and cancer?" I pulled myself out of bed, plopped heavily into my wheelchair, and stared at the mirror with my fingers splayed across my growing belly. That day we had to decide if my partner Micah would start a second round of chemotherapy treatments that would weaken his ability to fight against the new virus if he caught it, or forego the treatment and change his odds against cancer. Our baby would arrive in a few weeks. That spring, as my feet and belly swelled, my classes of high school students pivoted to virtual learning. I scrapped the original plans and assigned personal essays. "Let's bear witness to the here and now," I said. "One day we might even read these essays to our grandchildren." I wrote alongside them as we journaled every day, paying attention to the details, snippets of dialogue caught at the dinner tables we were now sitting around, the exact flavor of the cinnamon rolls we finally had time to bake, our body's reactions to sitting in front of screens for 8-plus hours a day, tiny flashes of human experience in the midst of a global pandemic. As soon as we started drafting our notes into essays, though, the plump, specific moments we had documented flattened under the task of shaping them. And I noticed many of us pulling in one of two directions. There were essays that skimmed the surface of loss. "I'm bored. I miss soccer practice. When will this be over?" And there were the essays of relentless positivity. "I'm finally getting to spend more time with my family. I'm learning to be grateful for what I have. I've had time to make so many cool crafts." The angsty drafts did not reach complete catharsis. The uplifting versions did not quite offer hope, and all of us struggled to stay present with our words. I was no exception. As soon as I tried to weave meaning from the tidbits I had been gathering, I watched my words splinter on the page. I gave up on the human race in one draft and extracted trite silver linings in the next. I had 10 tabs open on my computer. I obsessively checked for updates on new COVID-19 cases and scrolled through Instagram, eyeing a steady stream of dumpster fire memes and gorgeous photos of fresh-baked bread. I kept at least one hand on my belly at all times while the growing creature inside tapped Morse code messages to the outside world. "We're still here," he seemed to say. When I was very little, I survived childhood cancer. I don't know how that compares to surviving a pandemic. By the time I reached 6 or 7 years old, I had a script at the ready to testify to that survival, an actual script. I gave inspirational talks with my mom to groups of kids in schools or congregations of church folks. I'd look into the audience from my hot pink wheelchair and profess that cancer and paralysis had not decimated my spirit. "I'm happy this way," I'd say. "I can still play foursquare at recess." I could almost feel the energy in the room lift at my apparent resilience. I learned early and with unwavering consistency that there were only a handful of stories written for disabled girls. I could be the brilliant, bright inspiration sitting in my wheelchair on top of a mountain, or the pitiable and sad face of a charity fundraiser. There was not room for anything in between. It was not until almost 15 years later in graduate school when a guy in one of my classes called my bluff. He asked about my wheelchair, as so many people did, and without one thought I started, "I'm happy this way. My wheelchair has made me who I am, and I would not change that." "You don't actually feel that way," he said, shaking his head. "There's no way." He was confident, and I wavered. His words came back to me long after the conversation ended. Was he right? Had I only been pretending to be happy? I rifled through long discarded memories of loss, pain, and shame. The time a boy I thought was my friend told the group he did not want to invite me to go sledding because he didn't want to carry the cripple up the hill. the swoony older women who'd applauded my high school boyfriend for dating me, the incapacitating insecurity that went into hiding my deformed feet, my catheters, my anger, the physical and emotional exhaustion from trying to fit in and keep up. These moments suddenly became huge. The pang of them felt like it might swallow me whole. As I've gotten older, my body's challenged my ability to hold on to both and of being disabled. A couple years ago, my lower back pain became the host for new levels of pain. My legs started spasming and clenching regularly with an intensity I could not manage. After I bounced between doctors and underwent tedious tests, an orthopedic surgeon told me the pain was permanent. He could try to help me manage it, but there was no fixing the problem. "We're just kicking the can down the road," he said. My first feeling was claustrophobia, a frantic urgency to escape, get off this road, slip into another storyline. I think most of us would gulp down any magic potion promising to remove that feeling. How do you sit with the prognosis of pain for the rest of your life? Skipping ahead now to the final paragraph. For now, I'm allowing myself to be the middle of the story, to recognize that there isn't one story here, not even one story per person per day. I think it makes sense that we'd struggle to thread the words. This is too big, too fresh for the final line. But when we're ready to sit in the full stories we've been living, when we're safe and have space, all the pieces are here. Waving to each other through screens, breaking down during Zoom meetings, dancing in our driveways, choking on the chasm between ourselves and the ones we love without us in the hospital, spending hours on the phone catching up with every old friend and even more hours on hold with unemployment, splitting in half when our nightmares come true, exhaling with relief when they don't, showing up to the same mess day after day. These are our stories. They're tangled and complicated, but they're ours. Let them be messy, contradictory, true. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program's underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.